Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, we have a very special guest, but first I want to say it's been 3 years since I started this podcast, and it's been such an amazing journey. It's been incredible. I've learned so much about my own disease and other specific conditions that fall under, you know, the same umbrella. It's been an honor to interview incredible physicians, researchers, and families. And today specifically, you are going to meet and learn from Dr. Mark Tarnopolsky, a man who truly seems like he has the ultimate pulse on mitochondrial disease. He is in a league of his own, truly. He will introduce ways that we can potentially help ourselves at home with nutrition. And in just a few weeks, we'll have Dr. Mark back to talk about exercise. And I know from talking to people in the community, from our Facebook groups, from talking to the leadership team at Mito Action, exercise and nutrition are on everyone's mind, top of everyone's mind. So I'm glad that we have one gentleman that can kind of help with both. I'm really looking forward to this. There's a lot to talk about on each topic. So without any further conversation, I want to introduce Dr. Mark. He's a professor in the Department of Pediatrics in the Division of Head of Neuromuscular and Neurometabolic Disorders. He's a graduate of McMaster University and has been a faculty member there since 1996. He's also the chair in neuromuscular disorders for McMaster's Children's Hospital and the Hamilton Health Science Foundation, and he is recognized as an international leader in researching neuromuscular and neurometabolic disorders. I feel very fortunate to be learning from him and to be sharing him with our whole community. I can't believe it's been 3 years that I've been doing this that I haven't met you. So I hope that this is just the start of having you on from time to time on Energy in Action. So welcome, Dr. Mark.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
It's okay that I call you Dr. Mark, right?
Of course.
Okay.
Most patients do.
I can pronounce your last name, but I think our listeners will like hearing Dr. Mark. So welcome. Thank you so much for going through these topics with us. You know, a lot of our episodes are very conversation driven, and I really do think this one will be as well, but there are quite a few questions to ask. And I went through our Facebook groups to really make sure like the questions that folks are asking about the topics are definitely presented in these next two episodes. So hopefully there's something that you as a listener out there have been waiting to hear about, and you will today or in our next episode. So here we go. We're going to get right into it, all about nutrition. So this is, as we said, you know, this is a very big topic. There's a lot to talk about when it comes to supplements and diet. And when talking to a Mito patient, what are some of like the biggest questions you would ask them to best understand the position they're in as it relates to nutrition?
One of the challenges that many patients have is the high cost of food. And, yeah, you know, that's a real challenge, I think, for most people, because generally the cheaper the food is, the lower the quality. So it's very inexpensive to use high fructose corn syrup and to have highly processed foods and to mass produce them and sell them for low cost. So I think for a lot of patients, you know, we talk about, you know, increasing your vegetables and your fruit, but that really is contextual. I mean, in Northern Canada, you know, those are probably 4 to 5 times what they would cost in California for a lot of these things. So that's often a challenge for patients is to, you know, within the constraints of their budget, to follow the guidelines. And we'll talk about some of the things that, you know, have been shown in, you know, the able-bodied population, as well as, you know, we can extrapolate to mitochondrial patients that's going to be helpful. I think a lot of folks too don't think about nutrition in the long run, because some folks think mitochondrial is a deadly disease and, you know, who cares about nutrition because, you know, you're going to die from the disorder. And unfortunately, we have you know, a minority of folks who have very severe disease where that might be the case. But for most of our patients, they're living, you know, a long life and they want to optimize their nutrition. And so it's good to get a sense of what people are eating. You know, how often do they eat? You know, do they fast for periods of times? Do they only once or twice a day? Do they skip breakfast? Because there's a lot of little things that you can change just around timing of food, you know, how much you eat at a given time, time between meals, et cetera. And you can get a good handle on where you're at. And from there, you can start building on optimizing and nutrition and nutritional supplements.
So before you see a physician, when you want to talk about nutrition, it's probably good to maybe keep like a food journal so yeah, that when you arrive, you can have a good idea on what you've been eating.
And most physicians don't know much about nutrition and would not have a clue. But, you know, there are some general rules which are simple, but enacting them are more challenging. And that's where a dietitian or a nutritionist comes in. And many clinics will either have one associated with the clinic who can help to take the general guidelines we're going to talk about today and help someone to put it into action, you know, in terms of do you buy Bacel butter or, you know, margarine or whatever, and to, you know, take the general recommendations and to, you know, give people the more granular details. Physicians really aren't in a position to do that. And most of them, you know, if they did a 1-hour class in nutrition in their entire medical school, it'd be a miracle. So most physicians are very poorly educated, I suppose, in the area of nutrition. So therefore, bringing a diary to a physician, they're not going to have time to go through it. But when you are referred to a nutritionist or a dietitian, absolutely important. And generally, you know, try and write down what do you do on the weekend and what do you do during the week so you can get a better idea. And if you have a scale or a cup, measure things out. That's going to make it a lot easier for the dietitian or nutritionist to help you to know, is your protein adequate? Do you need other sources of, you know, calcium, vitamin B12, whatever it might be?
That's a really interesting idea that, like, I could sit down with my physician because, you know, I do understand that when I'm meeting with my mito specialist, nutrition is not the topic that him and I are speaking about. But I guess from my perspective, I guess I should have said the word specialist instead of physician earlier. But in theory, from the patient perspective, okay, so I sit down with my physician and I say, I want to meet with a nutritionist. Please help me create a template,
a food diary is, you know, one of the things that we would recommend.
But I think from the physician perspective, they could help create some specifics and some nuances about your condition in particular that you could take to the nutritionist, right?
Yeah.
Because it's such a broad spectrum of conditions.
Yeah. So it really is. You know, mitochondrial disease, you know, we see patients with muscular dystrophy and a whole host of other genetic disorders. There are ones where there are very specific recommendations. Mitochondrial disease is not one of them. So general healthy eating is really the core, because without it, people are going to become overweight. Once people become overweight or eventually obese, it increases the risk of cardiometabolic disease, you know, high cholesterol, various other things. And so it's really important to have a really good, healthy diet. There are a few nuances, you know, for example, children with complex 1 deficiency and seizures, the ketogenic diet. But, you know, we don't have time to get into that. That's a very nuanced, specific area. And every tertiary care center will have a ketogenic dietitian who works with them to impart that. But, you know, we wouldn't recommend a ketogenic diet for the general population. It's not going to be very palatable. It's hard to stay on it. But there are a few rare scenarios where it definitely is helpful. PDH deficiency, for example, complex 1 disorders with seizures that are hard to treat. Those would be some examples. But, you know, we can get into, you know, what is a healthy diet and, you know, what supplements might be of benefit, because you can't always get everything you need from an optimal diet.
Yeah, yeah. So when it comes to brain fog, a lot of us experience that. Is there any known food or supplement to help kind of reduce that element of the condition?
Yeah, I mean, brain fog is a, you know, kind of a colloquial term. You know, every person in the world has experienced it. But generally, the brain fog, whatever that is, we know what it feels like. We don't know biologically what causes it, other than a poor sleep. So non-restorative sleep is your number one factor. And I think, you know, people with mitochondrial disease think that it's unique to them, but brain fog is common across, you know, shift workers, you know, idiots like me who are working late in a grant at night. You get stressed about something at 2 a.m. So sleep is the most important thing you can do to reduce brain fog. If your sleep is impaired, make sure you talk to your physician about it. There's a variety of different sleep aids. We're big fans of melatonin because it's natural. It has some antioxidant properties. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're very enthusiastic about that, which is a natural product, which helps to put us to sleep at night. Optimal sleep hygiene. I actually have a whole list of optimal sleep hygiene things I can share with you that we can, you know, patients can access if they want. And, you know, because improving your sleep and getting that really deep stage 3 and stage 4 sleep will give you more restorative sleep. And what's interesting is at first people said, you know, oh, we don't know why this is happening. But there's recent data that the deep sleep activates things called the clock genes, and clock genes are known to be beneficial to mitochondria. So it truly is a mitochondrial dysfunction that tends to cause the brain fog. So that's number one. Number two, from a nutritional perspective, avoid the things that make you feel like crap. Everybody's had that 3 or 4 in the afternoon where you're totally trashed and you feel like you've got chronic fatigue syndrome. Usually it's because you've had a simple sugar and you've had highly processed food without a protein source. What happens then is those sugars get rapidly metabolized. They go up in your blood, you get a quick sugar high, and then you definitely get a crash afterwards. So avoiding those things, making sure that you have a good quality protein with your meal. So don't have pure, simple sugar snacks. People think, oh, this is the greatest thing for me at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, but then poof, by 4, they've crashed and burned and they feel absolutely trashed. So I think that's the number one strategy. And obviously having a little bit of protein, how that helps is protein slows digestion. So normally with sugar, it can be in your stomach, in your intestine, up in your blood within, you know, 5 or 10 minutes, and then down very rapidly. Whereas protein takes, you know, 3 to 5 hours to slowly digest. And so you get a more sustained delivery of energy. So I think having a little bit of high quality protein with every meal and avoiding those processed foods is another good strategy.
Okay, well, I feel like all of my contemporaries are focused on high protein diets and, you know, avoiding the processed food. So it's the same disclaimer for our community as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's certain, you know, things we have to be aware of with protein. I mean, it doesn't mean you go out and have, you know, tons and tons of beef, for example.
Yeah. Not all protein is equal, correct?
Exactly. So if you think about it from a protein perspective, you know, we split from birds and reptiles 220 million years ago. They chose egg whites and we chose milk as what we need to optimally grow our young. So milk and egg whites, interestingly, have the highest what's called biological value, which means that they supply all of the amino acids that are needed, the essential amino acids to build proteins within our body. So incorporating eggs and milk is a good strategy to have a very high biological value protein. And, you know, people sometimes like me who are allergic and not allergic, but intolerant of milk because you can't break down the lactose sugar. There's so many strategies now and options with lactate and various other lactose-free things. Protein powders that are isolates, not concentrates, but the isolates don't have lactose in them. So incorporating a little bit of milk-based protein or egg-based protein, you know, gives you good biological value. There's a variety of meats and fish, which are good. Again, you know, leaner cuts, and you don't need massive amounts. You know, 30, 40 grams is, you know, a very small portion, but that's going to give you a good amount of high-quality protein. And red meat is not the culprit that everyone thinks. The problem is that yes, if you eat a huge steak, that's not good for you. But you know, we now at home are cutting it up into smaller pieces, buying higher quality cuts, you know, sustainably sourced organic if you can afford that, in much smaller portions. But again, in everything's relative. You don't eat beef, you know, 5 days a week. We'll have it once or twice at most. Things like chicken, pork, fish, all of those things are high quality. Now, you can get your complementary proteins to get good biological value through plant-only sources. However, you really need a nutritionist to help you there because without it, many people just don't know what they're doing and you're going to get suboptimal protein. You're also potentially going to be deficient, certainly in creatine for sure, and things like vitamin B12, often, especially vegans, can be deficient in that and they're totally deficient in creatine. So there's some nuances, but generally, if you, you know, have a little bit of milk and some egg products, one or the other, and some lean meats throughout the week, you're probably getting optimal protein.
Well, that's good to hear. I was hoping for some sort of ingredient in food that would help reduce brain fog. Brain fog is something that I feel like I'm experiencing more and more. But if I focus, if I can now think to myself, I really need to focus more on my sleep and maybe shooting for an extra 30 to 60 minutes a night, or, you know, again, on the nights that I have trouble using melatonin, as you said, maybe I will see a reduction in that. And maybe it's not necessarily derived from food. But you hit on creatine, and that's a big topic. My physical therapist is pushing me to take creatine. I feel like a lot of people around me are talking about creatine. It's a focus. So there's also, like, you know, I'm hearing advice of like take more than what the suggested serving is. So let's talk all things creatine. Are right. you as jazzed about creatine as all these other people, articles, everything?
Well, it's almost comical to see everybody talking about creatine now like it's something new.
Right, right.
You know, this was not for you, but I'm saying, you know, in the blogosphere and, you know, all the hype. The first papers came out by the late, great Roger Harris in 1992, showing that taking 20 grams a day could load muscle. What I mean by that is creatine is something that's found in meat and fish. It's found in muscle in humans. About 90 to 95% is in skeletal muscle. It's involved in a number of different biological processes. Number one, it makes something called phosphocreatine. So if we have decreased energy source like mitochondrial disease, we flux through more phosphocreatine. And that's been shown with spectroscopy in the brain and in muscle in patients with mitochondrial disease, that they burn through the phosphocreatine quickly and it takes longer to recover phosphocreatine, which is why, you know, doing repetitive exercise tasks, which is where you use phosphocreatine and that sort of rest exercise transition, you kind of run out of gas quickly if you don't have adequate creatine. It's also a natural antioxidant, and it also facilitates the energy transfer between the mitochondria and what's called the cytosol of the cell. So very early on, after reading Roger's work and seeing excellent work coming out in 1996, that you only need 3 grams a day to load your muscle, we said, geez, this makes a lot of sense for our patients. So we were the first in 1999 to do studies in muscular dystrophy and in in mitochondrial disease to see if it was beneficial. As we would expect, that higher intensity contraction, we had greater than 10% improvement in our patients with Nielas syndrome. We then did a study in muscular dystrophy, and it was 11 or 12%, I can't remember exactly, in a variety of muscle diseases from limb girdle dystrophy to sporadic inclusion body myositis, all of which have secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. We went on to put forward a hypothesis in 2001 that multi-ingredient supplements containing a mitochondrial enhancer and creatine was beneficial, and were the first to show that that was beneficial with mitochondrial patients in a randomized double-blind trial in 2007. So we've been advocates of it for a long time. So it's interesting to hear all these people that don't know anything about creatine, you know, trying to say how great it is. And also the garbage out there to say that you need 20 grams a day to load brain is completely ludicrous. You know, part of it is based on the fact that it's hard to measure brain creatine levels, unlike muscle, where we can do a biochemical assay. So it's a little more imprecise, harder to measure the effect. But good studies, there's a fellow, Serge Ostiak, who's a professor now, who is in the United States. He did a study where he simultaneously measured brain and muscle in people with chronic fatigue syndrome who took 4 grams a day. And what he found is that the levels going up in the brain were about 9%, and muscle was about 9%. So I think the data, and others have shown that, you know, even smaller doses, you know, 3 to 5 grams, still you can see cognitive benefits. So we're of the opinion, and the data strongly suggests, that taking anything more than 100 milligrams per kilogram, which is about 7 grams in an adult, is, you know, you're just wasting your money and time. And in terms of side effects, yeah, we do see stomach upset in some people, and the higher the dose, the more likely you are to have those side effects. So going above 7, you're just putting money in the pockets of companies and you're doing yourself no favor. So, you know, studies have shown a whole host of benefits in terms of, you know, improving muscle function. There have been innumerable preclinical studies showing benefits in Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease. We've done studies in Lou Gehrig's disease. All of those are disorders where there's secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. So I think there's a big role for creatine. Even myself, I take it just for normal human aging. There's studies, interestingly, with sleep deprivation, which is one of the main areas where it seems to improve cognition, and that might be one of the other things to think about from a brain fog perspective, especially if you have poor sleep, is to be on creatine. Studies have clearly shown benefits there. So yeah, so we're big fans of it. The problem is there is so much garbage out there. the powder. So this is a very reputable company, for example. It's called Creapure. It's by Allschem in Germany. They were really the first, and they supplied us with all of our studies to, you know, publish data, because they supplied the creatine for all of the original studies. Creatine monohydrate. So creatine, when you buy it as a powder, can be complex with other molecules like hydrochloric acid or ascorbate. There's no benefit to any of those other things. They're just more expensive and lining the pockets. Good old creatine monohydrate. Reputable company, because there can be contaminants, and there's, you know, some concern when it comes from certain other countries that there could be contaminants. So, you know, Chem is a good quality brand. Powder, many patients don't like it. And the reason they don't like it is, I don't know if you can see here, there's a powder on the bottom. This is creatine monohydrate powder sitting in water. If you shake it up, it'll go into suspension, but it won't dissolve. So if I leave that for 10 minutes, it'll just precipitate out like this. So if you're taking creatine as a powder, put it into something more viscous, yogurt, applesauce, whatever. Or if you put it into apple juice or whatever, just shake it up and drink it, you know, because the particulates will eventually settle to the bottom. So you have to kind of shake it up a bit. Because of that, people say, ew, I don't like creatine. I hate taking powder. So people are selling all sorts of other things. This is a gummy. This claims to have 2.5 grams in this one gummy here. This is the biggest pile of garbage healthcare fraud in the world.
Really?
This little gummy weighs 2.5 grams, and they're claiming
they're claiming that as
2.5 grams of creatine. One is crystal clear, which means that creatine's dissolved. Creatine's dissolvability in 2.5 grams of water would be about 36 milligrams, and they're saying there's 2,500.
Huh.
This is healthcare fraud. This has the claim. It has a Canadian NPN number, which is almost like having a DIN number for a drug in Canada. It's not being policed, and these criminals are selling this for $40 for essentially some gummies that would cost about 4 cents to make.
Wow.
With zero creatine. And on their website.
Are there any creatine gummies that you would recommend?
Yeah, a recent study looked at most of the creatine gummies, and most of them don't meet label claim.
Yeah.
If they do meet label claim, I was just recently at an event where a company was making a creatine chew. But, you know, it doesn't taste great. It doesn't taste like, this is pure sugar, so it tastes great. But there's zero creatine. The chew tastes kind of like, you can tell there's creatine in it. It's very dry. The more water in something, the shorter the expiry date. But unfortunately, creatine gummies, even if they have creatine in them, will expire very rapidly, because the gummy itself has water in it, and it'll break it down to creatinine. So if there's no rapid expiry date, then, you know, it's just going to break down. It has to be opaque, because it'll never dissolve. Like, to dissolve 2.5 grams of creatine, you'd need like a huge glass of water to dissolve it, or more, because this has been sitting on my desk for months and I keep shaking it up, and that's only 1 gram of creatine and that much water, and it still won't dissolve.
Wow.
So to think that 2.5 grams is going to fit in that little gummy is just a complete healthcare fraud. But unfortunately,
it's crazy they get away with it. It's probably a whole other podcast episode, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Unfortunately, though, this is a big issue for everybody here. If you are taking any supplements, it's hard to know what to buy.
It's hard. Like, yeah.
You need experts like me, and, you know, many other friends are. I'm not saying I'm the only one, but powder for sure, and creatine monohydrate for sure.
Monohydrate.
Now, conflict of interest, where we have created stuff based on our first study because we couldn't find it for our kids with Duchenne dystrophy. We have created a tablet. So this is pure dry powder, but you see the size of this, that's still only 1 gram of creatine in there that we can press in. So
wow.
A crunchy tablet, dry tablet, I'm not saying buy ours, you can get anyone out there. There's not many out, but that is another valid way of getting creatine. But, you know, if you want 7 of these, you got to crunch down 7 of these pills. Unlike these guys lying and saying you can crunch down 3 of those and you're going to get 7.5 grams of creatine. So those are some of the better ways of taking it. A liquid. Anything that says it's liquid is full of garbage. You can't
dissolve
it in liquid. Yeah.
Okay.
So those are important things when you're taking creatine. But again, no more than 7 grams a day for pediatric dosing, 100 milligrams per kilogram per day, total dose. Divide it up or take it all at once. Doesn't really matter. At the end of, you know, 1 month, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, we've done studies. Yeah, you get to the same level.
I need to be more religious about taking it every single day. So this is going to be my starting point. Starting today, I'm going to take that a lot more seriously. You have some really interesting things to say about it. So, you know, zooming out a little bit, let's talk about the mito cocktail. You know,
I've had my diagnosis for almost 20 years. My specialists have always, you know, talked to me about taking it, and they all seem to be kind of on the same page about what I should be taking. But some days I wonder, do I need to be taking like all eight of these pills? You know, are they really helping me? How do I know without a pause in taking them? Kind of talk to us about that.
Sure. So as I mentioned, in 2001, we put forward, Flint Beal, who's a neurologist in New York City, and I put forth a hypothesis that we need to target multiple final common pathways to have a cocktail work. So in mitochondrial disease, there's a whole bunch of processes, oxidative stress, which is very targetable by nutrition, mm-hmm. activation of apoptosis, inflammation, all of those things happen. So you can't get by with a single drug or single supplement, which is probably why every drug pretty much has failed miserably in mitochondrial disease, because they're taking a pharma-centric single molecule, single pathway approach. So what we did in 2007, when the UMDF and nobody else would fund me because they wanted to get a cure in an animal model or a petri dish, when all of our patients said, well, what the hell actually works? So out of my own pocket, I funded a study where we used that hypothesis. We used alpha-lipoic acid, which is a known antioxidant in the mitochondria involved in three important pathways. Coenzyme Q10, which everyone's familiar with, is a link between complex 1 and complex 2 and complex 3 of the mitochondria. We then wanted to protect the membranes with vitamin E, which is a chain-breaking antioxidant. And of course, creatine monohydrate for all the reasons we just discussed. So we use alpha-lipoic acid, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, and creatine in a randomized double-blind crossover study, meaning we didn't know, the patients didn't know what they were on. They were on it for 2 months, off of it for two, and on placebo for two. And then at the end of it, we looked at how people did. What we found is the markers of mitochondrial dysfunction are lactate, as everyone knows, and we use two markers of oxidative stress. One is DNA damage, one was lipid damage. Anyhow, I won't say what they are, but both the oxidative stress markers were down and lactate was lower when they were taking the supplement versus a placebo. So that was the first randomized double-blind crossover study. In typical fashion, all the drug-centric doctors said, oh, it's garbage. You know, you can't use multiple things. We don't know what's working, which is illogical because we know there's so many multiple final common pathways, ignoring my hypothesis. But anyhow, using my own money, I did a study in 30 patients with Milas syndrome mainly, with spectroscopy of the brain, the whole bit. And we used 600 milligrams twice daily of coenzyme Q10, good hydrosoluble CoQ10 from Tishcon. And what did we show? Nothing. There was no reduction in oxidative stress, no reduction in lactate. So again, showing that single molecules are not likely to be a benefit. Idivenone, again, another single molecule, is just an analog of CoQ10. So we're firmly of the belief, and our study clearly shows that the multi-ingredient supplement works. The problem is that people throw everything in the dog in there and come up with these crazy cocktails, which makes it more expensive for patients, no proven efficacy. And what worries me most is we've done studies sometimes where we make an incredible antioxidant in a petri dish. It works great. We give it to a human, it becomes a pro-oxidant. So I think, you know, if you go much beyond the cocktail that I talked about, you know, show me the evidence in a randomized trial in real patients that you're actually affecting the fundamental biochemistry of the disease, and then I would include it. Now, there's things that we recommend and we add to the cocktail. Number one, check and replace deficiencies. 15% of our patients are vitamin B12 deficient. 4% are folate deficient. Vitamin D insufficiency, 85% of our patients. 15% are severely vitamin D deficient. So we check all of those and we add a replacement. So replacing a deficiency of a vitamin or mineral, which is known to negatively impair mitochondrial function, is low-hanging fruit. But most doctors, they don't think, oh, it's not a drug, so it's not important. But well, tell that to my patients who lost the ability to walk just from B12 deficiency, who didn't have mitochondrial disease. So you don't want to miss that low-hanging fruit. The other one that you don't want to miss in mitochondrial disease is low iron. So for women, ferritin is your best measure of your iron stores. And I say women because they're more likely to be iron deficient. And I recommend to all of my patients that you would want to get your ferritin levels over 50. Now, there are some doctors who don't, you know, understand fundamental biology who think, don't worry about your iron stores as long as your hemoglobin is normal. The problem is that if you're iron deficient, it can affect your iron sulfur clusters in the mitochondria. So it's even more important for a mitochondrial patient to make sure that they have adequate ferritin stores. And so that's critical. And that's really important because many of the women we see, especially younger women, they have low ferritin and we try to get that up. So those are things that we add. There's other things that one could logically add to a cocktail. So if, for example, you had a complex 1 deficiency, we usually like to add in riboflavin. Depending on what your mutation might be, there's riboflavin transporter deficiencies, and clearly high dose of riboflavin in that scenario are things that we would add. Thiamine is certainly something we add if there's PDH deficiency, and there's thiamine transporter deficiencies as well. So, you know, there's other nuances to it, but we call those 4 substances I talk about the core. So if you're not taking that core, you know, ask your doctor, where's the randomized double-blind trial that shows that what I'm taking is actually beneficial? And they won't find anything because it never gets funded because people want a drug and they want to make millions and millions of dollars. And they don't really care about nutrition or exercise, which really is, when, you know, it's all we've got at this point. And, you know, there's many doctors out there. And I was just in a battle with 2 of them who were saying that anyone who even thinks that the mitochondrial cocktail is worth giving is totally decerebrate. And it's illogical and stupid to recommend mitochondrial cocktail to any of your patients. And these are top, I would say their names, doctors in the United States who are saying that.
Wow.
Oh yeah.
Huh.
Some of you are probably wouldn't be treated by them because they don't believe
not
in
me,
anyway.
Because I am on mitochondrial cocktail.
Well, the other I say to those 2 people is, well, you show me the randomized trial that you've shown that shows that they don't work. A and yeah. B, get your butt out there. Use your own money as I did, you know, out of altruistic care for my patients and pay for the study out of your own money to do it because UMDF, nobody funded these studies.
Wow. Well, I'm really happy to hear that you did and that you can confidently talk on this topic, right?
We spent a lot of time thinking about it.
So let's talk about fad diets because I think about them a lot. My friends talk about them. They try them. I always think, I'm probably not a candidate for some of this stuff, like intermittent fasting. Like I shut down, my body shuts down if I, you know, go too many hours without eating. I'm in bad shape. So I have a hard time understanding, should I listen to some of the news about some of these fad diets? Should I just turn a blind eye to all of them? What are your thoughts as in the mitochondrial disease community?
Yeah, there's a scientific aspect and a philosophical aspect to this. I think the scientific aspect is what's the evidence for it? Now, certainly, you know, caloric restriction is of benefit to nematodes and various other animals, never been proven to be beneficial in humans. I do think that for the general population, we have highly processed foods, we're taking in too many calories. So dropping your caloric intake to match your expenditure is not an imprudent thing. But for the population to, you know, try and cut 30 or 40% off their nutritional intake is going to limit also the ability to get adequate protein, to get vitamins and minerals. You have to be very, very careful, especially when many patients with muscular dystrophy or mitochondrial disease are either weak and or they have exercise intolerance. You don't move as much, you don't burn as much energy. You try to, you know, take in 2,000 or 3,000 calories, which they recommend for an able-bodied person, and you're going to become obese. So there's a lot of nuances there. So intermittent fasting, you know, gained a lot of popularity, which is a form of caloric restriction. The theory there is that while you're fasting, you activate AMP kinase, which activates ULK1, which activates something called autophagy. And mitophagy, you clean up the bad parts of your cell, clean up the bad mitochondria. The challenge there, as you pointed out, is many people just can't tolerate it. You know, I know my wife and daughter would kill me if they went 4 hours without eating. Some people like me, I mean, I can go 12 hours, no problems without eating. But then when I get home, I tend to overeat because I'm starving. But you know, it doesn't bother me during the day. So I think everyone's a little different. But studies have shown, you know, when you really start changing around, you know, fast rate, 16 hours out of the day, eat only in an 8-hour window, you know, do 2 or 3 day fastings, I would caution against that. Certainly with some of our more fragile children, if you get a bit dehydrated, that's what triggers seizures often in our MELAS children. So, you know, fasting often means decreased fluid intake. So they get a bit dehydrated and I don't think that's a good thing. So many of our patients, you know, tend to graze a little bit more. I would recommend not skipping things like breakfast. You know, there is some data from an obesity perspective that one of the factors associated with those who are overweight or obese is missing breakfast. And most of the data shows it's probably ideal to take at least 20 grams of protein with breakfast, 20 grams with lunch. And most people are getting well over that at dinner time. But it's the folks who are tea and toasters at breakfast just having sugar, not a good idea. So spreading out your protein throughout the day, three meals throughout the day. And, you know, I've been in the field for 40 years. I did my PhD in a nutrition department in cell biology and metabolism. So I had a foot in the whole nutrition camp. What really makes sense is, you know, kind of the Mediterranean diet. You know, it's not really that Mediterranean. It's logical, you know, have more vegetables, more fruits. I'm a big fan of color. Now, when I say fruits, not fruit juice, fruits have, you know, skin and other fiber that helps to slow down that absorption. Whereas when it's pressed into a juice, you know, it's no longer a healthy choice. So real fruits, real vegetables, berries, colored berries, you know, and they're readily available usually in North America. Whole grains, you know, I know that we won't get into your current guidelines in the United States because they're not based in science, they're based in craziness. But, you know, whole grains, nuts, everything in moderation. And then, you know, clearly salads and, you know, healthy oils. People, you know, thought oil is always bad, fat's bad. But there's a variety of oils that are good for you. You know, olive oil, even a little bit of butter is fine, you know, if you enjoy it. But everything in moderation. Interesting, in the New York Times, there was an article about how amazing the Nordic diet was because it had rapeseed and how horrible canola is. Too bad they don't realize that rapeseed and canola are the same thing. So...
Oh my gosh.
I knew that because
there's so much misinformation out there, right?
Oh, it's shocking. Yeah. My uncle is a farmer, so I knew that they used to call it rapeseed and then, you know, it was politically incorrect. So then they call it canola.
Yeah. It's a really horrible term.
Oh, it is. But because it was politically incorrect, they changed it, but they still use that term in Europe. And they were saying, oh, this is part of the Nordic diet. Why is it so good for people? And then saying that canola is so bad. So, you know, I don't be afraid of, you know, most of the fats and oils in moderation. Again, you know, everything in moderation, but I think a wide variety, more color, closer to mm-hmm. source. The challenges I brought up right at the beginning is that does tend to be a little bit more expensive. Now, fortunately, because of a variety of things, you know, one of which is allowing proper immigration, you get lower cost food. I mean, California does not run on, you know, a bunch of rich, spoiled white kids going and picking, you know, berries or nuts in the field. And so because of that, you know, the United States and Canada and Mexico to some degree have reasonable access to fairly low cost quality foods. Avoid overprocessed foods. We've mentioned that.
Yeah.
In terms of meats, as I pointed out, you know, lean beef is fine, just not in excess, and fish and chicken. Boom, that's a Mediterranean diet.
Right, probably
the best thing you can do.
So maybe kind of have tunnel vision when it comes to that particular diet and kind of keep the rest out of my mind, right? Because there's going to be new stuff, you know, a year or two down the road, there's going to be a whole new thing. Or, you know, when the Atkins was so big and, you know, people still really try to cut carbs. And I mean, there's also, like what you said, whole grains is really important. And fruit, that all has carbs. So, you know, creating a low carb diet, you probably shift your mind away from, you know, having as many fruits and whole grains, and then you're creating an issue for yourself. So,
right. Very good point. You know, all this, you know, war on carbohydrates, it's contextual. Yeah. I absolutely firmly believe, and the data is very strong, that simple sugars, you know, white cane sugar, high fructose corn syrup, highly processed sugars that mm-hmm. come in quickly, spike rapidly in your blood, are never good for you. And there's no added value. There's no vitamins or minerals or fiber or anything else. But when you stick to carbs that come from nature and closer to nature, like berries and fruit and other things like that, and even, you know, whole grain breads, they're tasty, they're good for you. There's many other things that come with them. But again, one of the strategies is if you do want to enjoy a little bit of dessert that has some sugar in it, take it with food, because when your meal is digesting, it's going to slow that absorption. But taking, you know, a small candy or a chocolate bar, whatever it is, in the middle of the afternoon, bad idea. It's going to go in quickly. It's not going to be diluted down by all the proteins and other and fats, which slow down your absorption.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's all contextual when you take things in. But avoiding those highly processed simple sugars is always a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, we've hit on that point so many times during this episode, but I think it is really important. And especially in the U.S., those processed foods are everywhere. So, and with the price of food just going up astronomically,
those types of foods become a lot easier to handle or a lot easier to, you know, make a priority. So
another final point, just thinking about it, is we did a study where we were doing essentially like an insulin tolerance test where we give people glucose and see what happens to their insulin and glucose. And what we noticed is lactate goes up. So if sugar comes in too quickly into the system and your mitochondria can't handle it, you actually spike your lactate. So again, another really important reason why you shouldn't be, you know, taking high carb, high simple sugar carbs on an empty stomach. You don't want that spike because your lactate's going to pop up too for, you know, up to an hour after.
Oh, wow. Okay. I think you've been so helpful. I really, really appreciate all of what you've been telling us. I wish there were more people with your knowledge base about nutrition. Why do you think there's such a lack of education within the nutritional or within the dietitian community about mitochondrial health?
You know, certainly what we find is when you talk to folks about it, there's more understanding of what the mitochondria are and more interest for dietitians and nutritionists. I think the challenge is finding a physician that, you know, would care at all, because it's never part of your standard medical curriculum to learn about nutrition. So it kind of gets pushed to the wayside. You know, we're so drug focused and, you know, all doctors care about is a drug. I want a drug. And I've had patients tell me, look, I don't care about exercise. I don't care about nutrition. You know, my kids got Duchenne dystrophy, but I'm not going to exercise them or give them creatine or anything. I'm just waiting for that cure. And I've been in the field for over 30 years. There still is nowhere close to a cure for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And my kids who eat well and exercise do much better, walk longer, have better cardiovascular and pulmonary health than those who sit around and become obese and do absolutely nothing. You know, and even if therapies like for spinal muscular atrophy, we have as close to a cure as we're ever going to get because of the uniqueness of that disease with gene therapy, the kids still take creatine, CoQ10, exercise, and my kids are doing so well. It's crazy how well they do. So they're not mutually exclusive. And if you're going to live by some new therapy, be it gene therapy or some other drug that comes, you still have to think about your nutrition. You've got to think about exercise like I do as an able-bodied person. So, you know, I don't die from cardiovascular disease and other things that are going to shorten my health span and my lifespan. So we want everyone with mitochondrial to live to as best they can, a healthy health span and as long a lifespan as possible, and hopefully no different than the able-bodied person. And that does require attention to exercise and nutrition, even if we had a quote-unquote cure.
So why, as a patient, is it so hard for me to find a nutritionist that has this knowledge base?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, you know,
because to your point, the research shows we all should be, I mean, every person should be focusing on this. But if you have, you know, a condition that you'll have the rest of your life, you know, you should take added precautions and added attention to it.
Part of it is education. So programs like this, you know, hopefully do help to educate and help people are learning something from this. You know, hopefully there's some dietitians and nutritionists here. I do find that, you know, either exercise physiologists or nutrition dietitians, when they are aware of a specific disease, those that are worth their salt will go and read about it and they're excited and interested.
Yeah.
So again, if
it can be hard to find that kind of person, though.
Well, if you don't move on, because, you know, I'm telling you, we've had so many folks who are just so excited and interested and they want articles and they're, you know, they take it as, because, I mean, you got to, if you're a nutritionist and dietitian and you have, you know, 100 people who are just, you know, nothing against being overweight, but who are overweight and you're saying the same old stuff. And then you've got this patient with this really cool disease that, you know, wow, I got to start thinking about this. And how do I package good quality food into only 1200 calories because the person's not moving quite as much with muscular dystrophy or mitochondrial disease? I mean, that's the challenge. And to me, I don't see why you wouldn't be excited about a new challenge and learning something new.
If you're passionate about what you're doing. Yeah.
Otherwise, if you don't, go get another job, go work at McDonald's. Right.
I think that's an important point that as a patient, sometimes it's hard to think about. Like, if you're not getting the care you need, move on. You know, maybe someone else out there will be able to do the research that you're hoping they will, and it'll create benefit for you long term.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's sometimes can be challenging. You know, I feel for folks too, traveling, you know, sometimes you're stuck in a state, for example, where there's only one center and, you know, there's no degrees of freedom for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I think with podcasts like yours and with the increased availability of the internet and stuff, you know, I think the information is getting out there. The challenge people are going to have is separating the wheat from the chaff, because yeah, there are so many yeah, folks, you know, who are promoting all sorts of crazy stuff.
We've been
no
talking
benefit
about today, gummy yeah, vitamins that don't have any ingredients in them practically. Yeah.
And every week now, people are coming up with some new mitochondrial enhancer, you know, NAR and urolithin A. And when you really, 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 really know the literature, you'll see, well, okay, show me what it's doing for a patient. Yeah. Show me in a patient that you're actually lowering oxidative stress in a human or improving mitochondrial function in a human, number one. And then number two, in the disease that we're talking about. And the data is absolutely not there or massively flawed.
Well, Dr. Mark, I'm hoping that you can be a guest on our podcast semi-regularly so that we can talk about all of this and things that are in the news, and you can kind of go through what you support and what is pure garbage out there, because it is really hard to decipher it all on your own, you know. But I know that supplements and nutrition, you know, the food you're eating on a daily basis, it's such a big topic for our community. And I really appreciate all of the attention that you've given to our community today by talking with us. And again, we're going to have you on for a second episode just in 2 weeks to talk all about exercise. And as we've been talking, I've been thinking maybe we should make it a 3-part series with sleep. But at some point, you'll hear from him again about that. I'm gonna ask him about that one offline, everyone. So, Dr. Mark, thank you so much for being here. And again, we will hear from him in a few weeks about exercise. So stay tuned for that one as well. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.